This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with a student and professor from Columbia University about recent charges that they disrupted a controversial speaker.
The controversial speaker, Tony Robinson, was a right-winger from Great Britain who was brought in by a nationally organized campaign to provoke a reaction from the Columbia students, and then the Columbia students would then be victimized for their protesting this racist. The response by the Columbia faculty and students was really instructive. Listen to this.
We'll examine how ICE is targeting immigrants in courthouses.
ICE's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they've instituted an extremely harsh rule since Trump came into power.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
On October 10th, 2017, the notorious British anti-Semite and Islamophobe Tony Robinson appeared by Skype on the Columbia University campus. He was invited by the College Republican Club. Many Columbia University students registered for the event and protested the things he said. The protesters did not disrupt the event, but rather engaged the speaker's comments. 17 students were subsequently investigated and interrogated and charged with Columbia University rules violations for, quote, briefly interrupting a university function or, quote, disrupting a university function or rendering its continuation impossible. We speak today with attorney and Columbia law professor Catherine Franke. She's been working with and representing 19 students at Columbia who protested at the event. Catherine Franke is a former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and currently the chairwoman of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. With her is Kayum Ahmed, one of the students involved in the protests represented by Attorney Franke. Mr. Ahmed was the former CEO of the Human Rights Commission of South Africa. Kayed Ahmed is a doctoral fellow in international and comparative education at Teachers College at Columbia University and an adjunct faculty member at the Columbia Law School. Catherine Kayum, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back with you.
Excellent. Thanks to be here.
Kayum, tell us about the Columbia University Republicans, please.
Where do I start? The College Republicans see themselves as a political organization modeled on the larger Republican Party. And essentially what they attempt to do is to foster debate and discussion, according to their website, around questions of free speech. And they started a free speech month during October 2017, in which they invited a series of speakers that we found deeply problematic and offensive. Many of these speakers would be classified as alt-right or right-wing speakers. But of course, they claim to be doing this in the name of freedom of expression and free speech. And one of these speakers, of course, was Tommy Robinson, who has created quite a lot of contentious debate and discussion around questions of Islam and Islamophobia, but also around issues of gender equality and misogynistic views that he's expressed in the past. So we recognize the College Republicans as a legitimate student organization, but one that has been deeply embedded in lots of problematic politics by inviting these speakers onto campus.
Can you talk a bit more about Mr. Robinson? What does he stand for? And what is his relationship with the Republicans on campus?
So as we understand it, the College Republicans state very explicitly that they don't necessarily endorse the views of people like Tommy Robinson, but they want to foster the sense of debate and discussion around the First Amendment in particular. Now, Tommy Robinson himself is the founder of the English Defense League, which is a right-wing organization that's deeply opposed to Muslims entering the United Kingdom. He's a British citizen who has, I am told, been involved in various fraudulent activities and has been sentenced and jailed for his activities in that regard. But what's quite interesting about the English Defense League is that it describes itself as a human rights organization and as an organization that's there to prevent the UK from dissipating into a Muslim or Sharia state, which of course is a little ironic But I think what the what someone like Tommy Robinson and the English Defence League, as well as the College Republicans, have in common is that they employ rights discourses, human rights discourses, and freedom of expression discourses, and they appropriate this in a way that perpetuates existing hierarchies and power. And I think this is potentially what they have in common. There are, of course, fundamental differences between these organizations and these individuals, but I think where they find some commonality is in how they interpret or perhaps misinterpret human rights discourses and free speech considerations.
Did something happen on campus on October 10th?
So October 10th was an interesting day for me personally, but for a number of us who decided to protest against Tommy Robinson, who came to speak on campus that day. Of course, he wasn't able to enter the country because of passport fraud, and so had to be connected via Skype to deliver a talk on what he classified as the major threat facing Europe at the time. And this is the Muslim threat, of course. So I had previously, in fact, about a week or so before, lodged a formal complaint with the university, trying to use existing rules to challenge the invitation to Tommy Robinson. And when I discovered that the university was not going to do anything about my complaint, or had limited, it seems, power to tackle the kinds of complaint that I was raising, decided to join a protest of about 200 students on October 10th, which led us from Harlem to Columbia University. And we protested outside the event, and then a number of us made our way inside the event where Robinson was speaking. There were approximately 150 students, the overwhelming majority of which were students such as myself who were deeply opposed to Robinson. The College Republicans made up a very small percentage of the students who were there. And as he started speaking, a number of us made our way to the front of the venue, stood with placards in the front of the venue denouncing white supremacy. And as a result of that, we were subsequently told by the institution, by the university, that we were facing charges of disrupting the event. We, of course, absolutely deny that that's exactly what happened. And what we were doing was attempting to exercise our right to free speech.
Let me ask your attorney, Catherine Franke, what were the students charged with? Who reported them? Who busted them? What were they alleged to have done?
Well, we know the answers to some of those questions, and we don't know the answers to others. Someone lodged a complaint with a university administrator who's in charge of enforcing the disciplinary code. It was never revealed to the students or to me who that person was. The university didn't feel it had an obligation to tell the students what the actual nature of the complaint was. But they were sent emails shortly after the event saying that they were being investigated for a violation of the disciplinary code and the provision that prohibits students from disrupting a university event or a club event like this event was. The language of the disciplinary code or the rules that are being enforced here is very vague. We have a whole process at Columbia for prosecuting, if you will, student violations of the code. But the beginning of it is a formal investigation by this one university administrator who then decides whether to dismiss the charges or refer them on to a formal hearing. And I entered at the point that several of the students reached out and said, we're under investigation for disruption. We feel like we were peacefully protesting. We didn't disrupt the event. There's a video, a Facebook video, that the College Republicans actually took of the event. It's quite clear that the protesting students did not disrupt it. They got on the queue and one after another asked, you know, very pointed, I think aggressive questions of Tommy Robinson, who actually never even gave a speech. He, at the beginning of the event, let the College Republican organizers know that he had no prepared speech. He just wanted to answer questions and basically inflame the audience. At one point, he held up a little sign, handmade sign, in front of the camera. He's, you know, on his laptop through Skype, and he had a little camera or a little sign that said snowflakes, as a kind of taunt of the students. And there was another student sitting in the front row of the event who had a Black Lives Matter t-shirt on, and he kind of picked on her. So his aim was to incite some kind of reaction from the audience, his aim was not to communicate any kind of argument or a perspective that would sort of enrich the intellectual or political community at Columbia.
And let's just be clear, when we talk about the term disruption, we mean an interference that the speaker can't continue in his or her presentation.
Well, that's your interpretation of the word, right? So all the rules say is that you can't disrupt an event. And I think the reasonable interpretation of that would be that you shout the person down so much that they can't speak. And that didn't happen. Quite clearly did not happen. The students were quietly, silently actually, protesting with signs in the front of the room. They weren't blocking the screen. They weren't blocking the speaker. And then other students got on the queue and asked questions. So any idea that they were disrupting it is a, I think, a misinterpretation of what happened.
So they were charged. There was an investigation. Catherine, you believe that the investigation was nothing more than a shaming of the students. And I wanted you to elaborate on that.
Well, there were a set of hearings or interviews, really, that the university administrator did with each of the students. She wanted to do it individually with each of them. And what they wanted to do was meet with her as a group. They had a real political kind of commitment to solidarity among them. Some of the students were quite young. They were freshmen and a little intimidated by the whole forum. Others, like KM, are experienced political activists, older, much more sophisticated in these kinds of settings. And they, I think they felt, as an act of solidarity with all of them, that they should appear before her together and express their position on what happened. She didn't allow that. She basically sat them down individually and lectured at them, almost shaking a finger, saying, you know that these rules prohibit speaking at all during an event or interrupting at all a speaker. That's what she interpreted disruption to mean. And all of the students that I worked with, there were 19 of them that were under investigation, said in answer to every one of her questions, I believe I complied with the rules. I believe I complied with the rules, and it kind of drove her nuts, I have to say. Because she kept asking these extremely patronizing questions, and they responded, I believe I complied with the rules, which was not, I mean, it was true. Mm-hmm. Would you say, Cam?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think Catherine's advice and guidance was fundamental and instrumental in the way in which we then engaged with the executive vice president of Columbia University. I think that had it not been for this kind of legal support and guidance, the students really felt deeply intimidated. Even as an experienced student myself, and I'm certainly one of the older students among the group that was being investigated, I recognize that I'm an international student. I'm at Columbia on a scholarship. And so consequently, I remain a vulnerable student in the context of dealing with the institution. So the support that we received was absolutely crucial to getting this eventually dismissed.
Chaim, what happened to you after you were charged?
So after I was charged, a few days later, interestingly enough, we also received an email from the provost of the university banning all of the students that had been that are being investigated from attending any further College Republican events. And this was an attempt, I think, to prevent us from, as they would call it, disrupting or interrupting future speakers that were being invited. There seems to be some unusual interpretation, perhaps misinterpretation of the university rules by the provost and by senior representatives in a way that, again, reinforces and entrenches the challenges that we've been facing, particularly as black and brown students on campus. As Catherine may have mentioned, there are a number of us who were facing potential charges and disciplinary action were black and brown students. And again, it often feels as if the burden is placed on us as marginalized groups to take on not only the College Republicans, but the university itself in dealing with our right to exercise freedom of expression. And this becomes deeply problematic that this burden, I think, is continuously placed on folks such as ourselves.
Well, and it was interesting to see that the primary university response to the Republican students bringing these really outrageous speakers to campus whose views would count as hate speech in any other context, the university's primary response was to prosecute the protesting students who were protesting peacefully rather than engaging in counter speech. And standing up for the students on campus, who I think rightfully were feeling that there was a hostile environment created by these speakers being defended by the university. So part of why a number of faculty, over 100 of us, got involved is we felt like we had to stand up for the students. The university wasn't doing it. They were prosecuting the students. But we wanted to stand up for them and say this is actually an environment that we're worried about, that these speakers are coming to campus and there's really no institutional counter speech.
In terms of standing up for the students, you in turn have charged the university with using free speech principles as an opportunity, as you've discussed, to prosecute students for their reasonable efforts to critically engage biased, exclusionary, anti-democratic speakers brought to the campus. Can you elaborate on this?
Well, make no mistake about this. This is a planned campaign of flooding university campuses, not just Columbia, many campuses across the country, funded with Koch Brothers money, but others, with these outrageous speakers. The game plan is to bring them to campus, to expect that the left students, students of color, Muslim students and allies will protest, that then the university will prosecute those students for violating some sort of disciplinary code, and then the university basically gets sucker punched into defending the rights of these outrageous speakers and not standing up for the students. And it positions these speakers as victims of hostile, intolerant, progressive students rather than allowing us to have a debate on campus about how this environment is being captured by the right and the universities are compliant or actually surrendering to this strategy by the right wing. So the faculty was very concerned about pointing that out. And I have to say, all of us on the faculty are enormously disappointed with how President Bollinger has handled this issue. You know, he's a free speech First Amendment scholar, but he is a liberal person in his own political commitments. And the fact that he just dug in, along with the cooperation of the provost, who's also a progressive good person, but dug in and actually engaged in censorship or, prior restraint of the students based on this one incident that, in other campuses, people have been drowned out by protesters, but not at Columbia. That didn't happen. They were actually engaging the speaker. We all have, on the faculty, found it shocking that Lee Bollinger would allow the university to be co-opted into this right-wing, completely foreseeable game plan.
I understand that 100 faculty members actually sent a letter to Bollinger. What was his response, and did the letter ask for anything?
It did ask for something. Actually, there was over about 125 faculty. People were begging to get on the letter. And we kind of walked through our objections to both the larger question of the university prosecuting students rather than standing up for the idea of the liberal university that is not poisoned by these sorts of speakers. But we were also concerned about the process of the students being really intimidated in these interviews and then told they couldn't attend or speak at other events, that the rules, I thought, were being misinterpreted in a way that's very narrow. And I and the students certainly did as well. Lee never responded. The provost did in his stead. He said, the president is traveling. I'm responding on his behalf. I walk by President Bollinger's house every day on my way to work. I know when he's home and he's not home. He has returned. He could have responded. But the provost responded and said, basically, we don't see a problem with what's happened. We stand up for free speech principles here. And the free speech principles we're defending are those of the speakers, not of the students. Because it is true that there's speech rights all over this issue. The invited speaker has some speech rights, and of course not First Amendment rights because we're not in a public context, but principles that I think every university should attend to. But the students have free speech rights as well, and their rights, I think, were being clearly violated by these prosecutions and the prior restraint by the provost.
What's the significance of the fact that over half of the students charged with the rules violations were people of color or Muslims?
I think this is an important dimension to this debate. I think, firstly, it represents or acknowledges the fact that many of the students who are deeply affected by this happen to be brown and black students who feel that the university is not creating the kind of space, the academic freedom that it is charged with to allow us to have an environment that is safe, that is conducive to learning, and that by inviting these folks onto campus is in many ways an act of violence, because hate speech, in our view, in our interpretation, does amount to an act of violence. So it's a different kind of violence, and often we associate violence with sort of physical attacks or damage to property. But this is a kind of violence that I think is deeply systemic and deeply rooted in sort of our colonial slavery, apartheid past that must be acknowledged. So I think that's the first dimension. The second is that we're not entirely sure who lodged the complaint against us. And so out of the group of about 60 or so students who were in that venue, it is incredible that those who were selected to be potentially charged ended up being a significant portion of us ended up being black and brown students. So this is potentially, again, reflective of the kind of counter-narratives that are being developed by folks. We suspect the College Republicans who lodged this complaint, but because the university refused to release this information to us, we're not entirely sure what their motivations were in lodging these complaints against us.
In addition to the letter that the faculty member signed on to, did the students do anything additionally to organize in their defense?
Absolutely. So in addition to meeting regularly and having further public events, both in sort of public spaces on the main steps at campus, we also held counter events where we invited various speakers to talk about questions of free speech. We have been involved in more recently training opportunities for students to counter these kinds of acts of hate speech. And we've been working with a number of organizations, both on-campus student organizations and legal organizations, to assist us in thinking through this. Professor Frankie has been incredibly helpful in this regard as well, and has just offered us some insights to look into how we should be approaching this as a more medium to long-term strategy, as opposed to focusing specifically on these moments. Because we recognize that this is a longer struggle and certainly part of a much broader struggle. So connecting to other university campuses, I was just contacted by the University of Connecticut, where they similarly had a similar challenge not too long ago, just last week. And so we are forming connections beyond Columbia. We are connecting to surrounding neighborhoods, and we are also continuing this debate and discourse around questions of free speech.
One thing that comes to mind when I think of this situation is, does the administration somehow feel a debt to certain alums who may be supportive of the Republicans, or can you speculate why this is?
That's possible. I think, you know, the university president is not insensitive to the views of the alum donors, and that may influence positions they take. I actually don't think that's the case in this situation. I think President Bollinger really feels he's standing up for a fundamental principle, and it's, you know, you often hear this around free speech commitments, is that our values are tested most when it's most difficult, right? And it's, I think he wears it as a badge of integrity that he is willing to stand up for the most odious speakers, not just the ones we agree with. And, you know, in principle, I think we all agree with that, but it's not the only piece of the discussion. It's not the only value at stake in contexts like this. And part of what I think is really curious about this case is that the way that the rules administrator, the administrator enforced, charged with enforcing these rules, and the president have interpreted the rules of discipline, give students fewer free speech rights than they would if they were in a public context where the First Amendment would apply. If these protests had happened at CUNY, right, the First Amendment would have protected the students even from disrupting a speaker. We have a constitutional right to disrupt speeches that we don't agree with. Drowning them out entirely, perhaps not, but this, there would have been a lot more leeway for students to express their disagreement with or protest or objection to what the speaker was saying in a public university than the way that that these rights are being interpreted in the private university context here. So I think that's one of the sort of sad ironies of this dispute.
The irony is that these right-wingers that come onto campus intentionally to provoke, they really don't believe in the mission of a university and of free speech and of community that discusses things. They come on the campus and they really sucker punch you guys, and it's been amazing.
Well, there also has been a history at Columbia of Muslim and particularly Palestinian solidarity activists, students who were expressing solidarity with Palestine, being assaulted even by people who disagree with their perspective, people who are defenders of Israel. And they have complained to the university that their speech rights have been violated and that the disciplinary code should be invoked, and the university has done nothing. So not only is the university not standing up for the Muslim students in a situation like when Tommy Robinson is here, but when the Muslim students need defending, when they're the protesters or the speakers, the university doesn't stand up for them either.
I want to ask this question of both of you. What lessons do you draw from this?
So for me, I think there are two major lessons. The one is how free speech rights and discourses around free speech have in many ways been appropriated by those in power, those in dominant positions, to perpetuate, I think, these sort of power hierarchies that we find in institutions that are meant to be spaces for debate and discussion, but also by right-wing organizations like the College Republicans. And I think this has been somewhat disconcerting in that it has created a culture and a climate that's been particularly problematic, and it's justified based on free speech rights. But I think secondly, the other major learning point for me is how this has in fact inspired younger students and people like myself to form a solidarity network on campus that probably would not have happened had it not been for these speakers being invited onto campus. So there's sort of a silver lining to this, in the sense that there are many disparate groups who often operate autonomously and independently of each other, who have now come together and who recognize that working together to deal with these sorts of oppressions, these intersectional type of oppressions, a particularly helpful strategy for engaging the institution. So that's been incredibly helpful for me.
Kim, if you will, could you tell us a bit about your background before you came to Columbia?
Oh, sure. So I, as you can probably tell from the lack of my hair, I know your listeners won't be able to see this. I'm an older student who is, I often say, going through my existential crisis. I was a human rights lawyer for a number of years working for the South African Human Rights Commission, where I served as chief executive officer from 2010 to 2015. My wife and I then decided to give up our jobs. We traveled for a little bit from Cairo all the way to Cape Town, and then I ended up at Columbia starting a PhD in international and comparative education at Teachers College. And the journey has been incredibly helpful for me because I've had the opportunity to step back from my work as a human rights lawyer and reflect on that. But also I found the space at Columbia to be incredibly enriching and fulfilling, in that I've now acquired a whole new way, I think, of looking at the world and looking at things. So my background in human rights and in human rights activism has assisted me, I think, in making sense of the current situation in a place like the United States. We were all, of course, incredibly surprised by President Trump's election. And there are some weird similarities between the apartheid regime, which I lived under for the first 18 years in South Africa, and what I'm seeing unfolding now in the United States. Clearly, there are significant differences between the two countries, but there are certain parallels that are deeply worrying for someone like myself who has experienced that kind of oppression firsthand in South Africa.
Before we have to close, I wanted to ask Attorney Catherine Franke, in your position as advocating for the students, could you sum up for us on your whole experience here?
Well, as KM said, there is a silver lining to this. I got to meet him, which has been a great delight for me. And I learned from him, you know, hearing the comparisons between the U.S. and apartheid South Africa is really interesting and important for all of us. It brought the faculty together in a way that we wouldn't have otherwise. I think our support for the students would have been more abstract and dispersed. So when the bear oversteps, we'll poke the bear back, and we have in this context. And I assume we'll have more of these kinds of speakers in the spring. But I would say that our strategy is not just to be reactive, not to just wait for them to come and protest. We've built, as KM said, a coalition on campus of folks who want to be more proactive in thinking about both how to protect free speech rights, but also how to make the campus a place where we're not just reacting to right-wing speech, but actually advancing a positive idea of justice.
Nicely said.
Well, Catherine Franke, Kayyum Ahmed, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Keep up your good work and report back to us because maybe we're not done with you.
Thanks, Michael and Heidi. It's great to be back with you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity. Really good to chat to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Although they have yet to hunt down undocumented people in churches or hospitals or schools, ICE is now arresting people inside of our state courthouses. Making people afraid to enter courthouses is another indication of the further disintegration of democracy, which has rapidly accelerated under the Trump administration. There have been hundreds of incidences of ICE arresting people inside of a courthouse in America this year, 70 in New York City alone. Just 2 weeks ago in Brooklyn, a rebellion of legal aid attorneys occurred when ICE tried to arrest a client of Brooklyn attorney Rebecca Cavanaugh's, who was there appearing on an order of protection matter. The persons arrested in courthouses are people that are free to leave, not in jail, not held on any charges, in all kinds of courthouses, including where people are coming to seek protective orders, in domestic violence situations, special human trafficking courts, and family courts. There has been a 900% increase in courthouse arrests in New York City alone this year. In response to this, there has been much organizing going on to get ICE out of the courthouses. Here to speak with us today is Andrew Wachtenheim, supervising attorney at the Immigration Defense Project. He works with IDP's nonprofit and pro bono partners on litigation before the federal courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals, and he provides technical assistance, litigation support, and training to immigration and criminal law practitioners on the immigration-criminal law intersection. Andrew Wachtenheim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Andrew, what has been the increase of ICE-targeted immigrants in courthouses since last January?
Yeah, in New York State this year, my organization, the Immigrant Defense Project, which has been monitoring ICE enforcement in the state courts and in New York State more broadly, has seen a 900% increase in rates of arrest and attempted arrests in courthouses throughout New York State since 2016. So it's really a dramatic escalation from the agency under President Obama to the agency under President Trump.
Would you call this a dangerous new era of enforcement, and if so, why?
Absolutely. You know, it is important to note that ICE and the other enforcement agencies within the Department of Homeland Security have a troubling history of problematic enforcement and interfering with human rights and rights under the Constitution and just generally disrespecting the rights of immigrants who are in the United States or trying to come to the United States. But what we're seeing under President Trump is just of a vastly different scale. You know, I think one notable indication of this new era of enforcement was the rescission of the Priority Enforcement Program. While my organization, IDP, certainly disagreed with the framing of that program because it did continue to inappropriately target huge swaths of immigrants who, should have been permitted to remain in the United States safely with their families and communities. But at least it indicated that the agency was making gestures towards complying with the Constitution, with the INA, and with the implementing regulations. But under President Trump, what we have is just an agency that all it wants to do is terrify, round up, and deport huge numbers of immigrants from the United States. And that includes people who are survivors of violence, people fearing persecution abroad, long-time lawful permanent residents, people with deep family roots here, people with no criminal justice contacts, with minor criminal justice contacts, people who have significant mental health issues. It's just there's no desire to prioritize. There's no desire to conduct individual assessments of someone's legal circumstances. It creates a situation that is dangerous for the immigrants who are being targeted, but it creates a situation that's dangerous for all of us, because we are lucky to live in communities that are mixed status. Immigrants and citizens and non-citizens live together, and when there's huge portions of the population that are not safe, the rest of us aren't either.
Andrew, your organization, the Immigrant Defense Project, released a report on November 15 detailing arrests and attempted arrests at courthouses across New York State since last January. How many arrests and attempted arrests were there? And if you will, what does this signify?
At the time of that report, we had received 117 reports of arrests and attempted arrests throughout New York State. As I mentioned at the start of this segment, that is a 900% increase in enforcement in New York State courts since 2016. So this is just a completely different enforcement landscape than we've ever seen before. And it reflects what ICE's highest leadership has said publicly, which is that they embrace this practice of raiding courthouses to scare immigrants from attending court. And we're seeing that play out in so many different spheres of civic life in New York. And we have all different indicators about this reluctance of people to be willing and able to participate in the court process because they are afraid that they will show up one day and, like their neighbor, that they will be seized and detained by a squad of plainclothes agents.
Totally understandable. Now, what kinds of services do courts offer that these people are then deterred from or frightened away from accessing?
It's a great question. Our state constitution has created the courts as one of the most important pillars of our government. We have huge systems of criminal courts, family courts, civil courts that address a range of matters across New York State. And just some of those include, adjudicating criminal charges, matrimonial cases, child support, visitation and custody agreements, abuse and neglect proceedings, wage theft and other employment exploitation, abusive tenants and other violations of housing law. So, the adjudications of petitions for special immigrant juvenile status for, abused and neglected young people who are unsafe in their country of origin. So our courts provide crucial services to the administration of justice in New York State. And, it can be even more complex than that. Through some of these matters, people can receive treatment for mental health issues. They can receive treatment for substance abuse. They can be identified as victims of human trafficking and given rehabilitative services, and it can assist with prosecution of traffickers. So these are vital services for universal access to justice and public safety, and these arrests are interfering with the ability of big portions of the population to access those services, and it's not fair and it's not lawful.
We're talking with Attorney Andrew Wachtenheim of the Immigrant Defense Project. Andrew, I want to ask you where the arrests are not taking place. Under the rules of ICE, they say it's, quote, too sensitive, end quote, to arrest people in churches or schools or hospitals. My assumption is when they say too sensitive, they're afraid that they're going to alarm the public, and the public's going to turn against them if they start ripping off people in schools or hospitals or churches. What's your thinking on that?
I think that might be true. You know, the policy that you're referring to is the Sensitive Locations Memo, which predated President Trump's administration, that designated some of the locations you listed as sensitive locations where immigration arrests can only take place in certain extenuating circumstances. I cannot predict what is going on within the leadership of DHS or ICE or in President Trump's inner circle, but I think that, you know, the public relations issue that you're alluding to sounds like a potential motivator for them to keep the sensitive locations policy at least superficially in place. But part of what's been so disturbing is that we are hearing reports of ICE and CBP agents making arrests in some of those designated sensitive locations and in violation of agency policy. And so I think this agency has given pretty much every indication that they feel unconstrained in what they're able to do with respect to apprehending, detaining, and seeking to deport people from this country. I am concerned that even those sensitive locations are going to be put in jeopardy soon, and it makes me even more nervous for spaces like courthouses where the agency has outright refused to designate as sensitive locations.
I'm curious, how do they know that certain immigrant is going to be at that courthouse that day? How do they operate?
So ICE has extraordinarily broad access to state law enforcement databases, and they have virtually unfettered access to fingerprinting information that is obtained through different parts of the court process, most particularly when someone is arrested in connection with some sort of criminal violation or a non-criminal violation that's processed through the criminal courts. And so, you know, that's how they get biographic information about a person who's having court contact. And in the majority of cases in the criminal courts, they are able to take that initial dump of information, and they are able to track that person's court appearances through publicly available information online. They will then send squads of agents to a courthouse on the date of a court appearance, and depending on whatever their strategy is for that particular day, they'll apprehend that person in different places or at different stages of their proceedings. But what I just described doesn't cover, you know, all of ICE's enforcement power. You know, there have been reports of arrests and attempted arrests in the family courts, and that information about that court appearances is not publicly available. And so it begs questions about what additional information is ICE able to access through these information sharing agreements with the states. But it also sometimes raises a question of whether there are Office of Court Administration staff who are affirmatively contacting ICE or who are inappropriately responding to ICE inquiries about people who might be present in court that day. And we have gotten reports that would indicate that there are New York State court personnel who are affirmatively contacting immigration agents to notify them of someone's presence. And that is a really, really scary idea.
Yeah, we call it police state.
Well, but that makes me wonder, do you think it's possible that there is sort of an unspoken policy from ICE to courthouse personnel, either offering some kind of incentive or pressuring them to come forth with that information?
I think it's a great question, and you know, I would hope that maybe you and others in the journalism sphere would press the Office of Court Administration to understand what it is that the federal government is asking of them and what kind of arrangements they've entered into, because the public statements from OCA leadership and from ICE leadership talk about high-level conversations between the two agencies. There have been protocols put in place about about ICE presence in the courts, and we have found them to be rather ineffective. But I do think that there is a lack of clarity about what this relationship is between ICE and OCA, and I think that it's a really important issue for OCA to clarify for the public so that we know what role they expect their staff to be playing in federal immigration enforcement operations. And, you know, in our estimation, from a public safety perspective, from a constitutional perspective, they should be playing no role at all.
Exactly. We concur, but my imagination is running just a little bit here, and I'm thinking we had the creation of so-called national security letters several years ago where you're not allowed to say or to divulge even to an attorney if you've received a national security letter. So I'm just wondering if there might be a device akin to that ICE is issuing in confidence, but we will try to explore that. I wanted to ask you, Andrew, in situations where we have especially vulnerable immigrants, such as those with mental health issues or, say, victims of domestic violence, does ICE operate in a more sensitive fashion with those people?
In our experience, they do not. We have seen virtually the same practices against those kinds of individuals in those vulnerable situations as we have in all other situations. And in fact, some of the most disturbing stories actually do involve people who have significant mental health issues or are survivors of violence. Thinking about one woman who she'd been attending court for more than a year without any problems, and she was receiving mental health treatment for, you know, significant trauma and significant mental health diagnoses through the court, and ICE agents trapped her outside of a courtroom and denied her defense counsel's offer that she voluntarily surrender, and they took her into custody and put her into removal proceedings, you know, and that's the same treatment that we have seen of pretty much all other non-citizens appearing in court. You know, we have, you know, reports of domestic violence survivors who were brought into the criminal court system on charges fabricated by abusers, who have been taken into custody as well. So, you know, consistent with the way this administration is otherwise enforcing the immigration laws, there's just no individual assessment. There's no prosecutorial discretion. There's no desire to attend to the fact that, you know, we have a responsibility to ensure that people in our communities are healthy and are safe, and ICE is not an agency that's invested in that mission.
Let's talk about the resistance to all of this. Andrew, what are advocates, people like you, doing to protect their clients and the people that they're serving?
One of the most heartening things about what I would describe as this courthouse arrest crisis is that there has just been an unbelievable mobilization in the legal advocacy community across New York State. I am so awed by the public defenders and other legal services lawyers who are starting to internalize counseling their clients about this issue as in the course of their representation, and just really trying to help their clients to be sure that they can safely access services and court appearances when they need to, and ensure that working with them to ensure that they can realize their constitutional rights to participate in the court process, their right to petition the court, to be present at trial, you know, all of the due process protections that the Constitution grants to citizens and non-citizens alike. So, you know, one big thing is that counseling clients and being available to give legal advice is a tremendous part of this resistance. You know, another part, and we've seen this particularly in the criminal courts in Brooklyn, you know, where ICE agents have really been, I would say, just out of control, an incredible effort to document this human rights abuse, you know, to try and intervene on behalf of clients and invoke their right to counsel, to, you know, encouraging clients to invoke their right to remain silent, trying to take photographs, to notify the press, to show the public what our federal government is doing. And then outside of the line defender community, you know, my organization, IDP, we are co-leading a coalition of more than 120 legal services organizations from all over New York State. And it includes public defenders, immigrants' rights organizations, civil legal services providers, law school clinics, organizations that represent survivors of domestic violence. And there's an incredible collaboration underway to, again, to document the experiences of these lawyers and their clients, because what's really awful about this is that the people who are most dramatically affected are the immigrants and family members of immigrants who don't feel safe going to court. And, you know, but they don't feel safe, and so they don't have a voice in this fight because they're afraid of this agency. And so what we are all trying to do is to give them a voice and to amplify that fear to elected officials, to the chief judge, to the chief administrative judge, and to encourage our state government to implement some rules and policies that would meaningfully intervene in this crisis and restore the constitutional right to universal access to the courts that doesn't discriminate based on country of origin.
Mm. Andrew, that's so essential, so needed. We're running out of time. How can our listeners learn more about this issue and about your organization, Immigrant Defense Project?
The best way to learn more about both IDP and about this issue is to visit our website. It's www.immdefense.org. And there is information about IDP's history at, advocating at the intersection of criminal immigration and family law. And we have a specific webpage devoted to the ICE Out of the Courts campaign. And there's information about the history of the practice. There's media coverage. There's an opportunity to share stories people have been impacted, and there are opportunities for impacted listeners to call us and contact us for legal advice if people are feeling unsafe in relation to this issue of ICE presence in the courts.
Mm, thank you so much.
Andrew, we're so grateful to have you on the program and to be able to give a helping hand to your ICE Out of the Courts program. Keep up the good work, and thanks so much for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both for having me. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye.
So long.
Bye-bye.
We welcome two new stations that are carrying Law and Disorder Radio, KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, where all my Armenian relatives live, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you. Please let us know how you like the show and any questions you have.
When John Brown went off to war to fight on a foreign shore, his mama sure was proud of him. He stood so straight and tall in his uniform and all. His mama's face broke out to a grin. Oh, son, you look so fine. I'm glad you're a son of mine. You make me proud to know you hold a gun. Do what the captain says. Lots of medals you will get. And we'll put them on the wall when you come home. When that old train pulled out, John's mom began to shout, telling everybody in the neighborhood, that's my son that's about to go. He's a soldier now, you know. She made well sure her neighbors understood. She got a letter once in a while. Her face broke into a smile as she showed them to the people from next door. And she bragged about her son with his uniform and gun in this thing she called a good old-fashioned war. Lord, good old fashioned on the whole. And the letters ceased to come. For a long time they did not come. They ceased to come for about 9 months or more. When it later finally came, saying, go down and meet the train. Your sons are coming home from the war. She smiled and went right down. She looked up and all around. But she did not see her soldier's son in sight. But as all the people passed, she saw her son at last. When she did, she could hardly believe her eyes. Oh, his face was all shot up, and his hand was all blown off, as he wore a metal brace round his waist. He whispered kind of slow, in a voice she did not know, while she could not even recognize his face. Lord, recognize his face. Tell me, my darling son, tell me what they've done. How is it that you come to be this way? As he tried his best to talk, but his mouth could hardly move, and his mother had to turn her face away. Don't you remember, Ma, when I went off to war? You thought it was the best thing I could do. I was on the battleground, you were home acting proud. Thank God you wasn't standing in my shoes. 'Cause I thought when I was there, God, what am I doing here? I'm trying to kill somebody or die trying. But the thing that scared me most was when my enemy came so close, and I saw that his face looked just like mine. Lord, Lord, just like mine. And I could not help but think, through the thunder sound and stink, that I was just a puppet in a play. And through the roaring smoke, the string had finally broke, and a cannonball blew my eyes away. As he turned away to walk, his ma was still in shock, seeing the metal brace that helped him stand. But as he turned to go, he called his mother close, and he dropped his medals down into her hand. Lord, Lord, out her hand.